It was 50 episodes today. Chris and Dave started a podcast.
Hey. Very exciting here. We are so excited.
Will you still listen to us when we're in our 50th episode?
Well, you're hopefully still here because it has been 50 episodes. We're very, very excited here today. It's our 50th episode, and it's a celebration of Sergeant Pepper and a celebration of you, our listeners, who have stuck with us and continue to give us great ideas and just be really supportive. So I want to thank all of our listeners, and for this particular episode, we threw it out to you guys to try to get some ideas for what we would do for our 50th episode, and we got some great ideas from a variety of people, from Kai and from Rachel and Michelle over in Italy, and some other people we may have forgotten from our list.
Yeah, lots of great ideas. We thought about it for several emails back and forth, and then we really were thinking, like, well, it's the 50th episode. It should be something pretty big, pretty smashing.
Yeah. Definitely. Something big and smashing, and what's bigger than the Beatles' 1967 album Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band for something to celebrate? And that idea came to us, it actually was called A Celebration of Sgt. Pepper, and it comes to us from friend of the show, Carl. And so we want to thank him for providing some ideas in this particular one. And rest assured, if we didn't pick your idea, we've cataloged them away, and we'll try to get to them in future podcasts. There's some really good ones.
Yeah, there's definitely a couple of them we're going to do next year, I'm hoping. So.
Yes, definitely. So let's get into it here. Celebrating Sergeant Pepper.
Have you received that stamp that I sent you in the mail and licked it? Since you and I
flying high together, yeah.
Talk about such a psychedelic album.
It is very psychedelic, and that's part of the big charm of this whole album. Here is all the psychedelic stuff that goes with it. Something to get us started here is this particular album, in more surveys than not, is always called the greatest rock album of all time, or just the greatest album of all time. And in fact, Rolling Stone magazine a few years ago did a 500 greatest albums of all time, one of those lists that everybody fights about all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. But they, at number one, of course, they had a lot of Beatles albums in the top 50, in the top 10 even. I think there were three.
Four in the top 10.
Four in the top 10, yeah. I mean, it's amazing. But number one was Sgt. Pepper, and I'll just read from the first paragraph here. Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band is the most important rock and roll album ever made, an unsurpassed adventure in concept, sound, songwriting, cover art, and studio technology by the greatest rock and roll group of all time. So that's a pretty strong opening sentence there to get us going here. So what do you think, just in terms of, you know, that we can maybe decide that at the end of the show if we feel that way, but it's certainly innovative, if nothing else.
It's very difficult to, first of all, very difficult to choose between probably about five different Beatles albums as being the best of all time, just of Beatles albums.
Yeah.
But certainly with that kind of a level of excellence, you would think a Beatles album should be number one.
Absolutely.
And it's as good of a choice as any of the others, particularly maybe sonically than Emotional Resonance or anything of that nature. There was a USA Today article called The Great Album Debate, Is Pepper the Beatles Best? And they asked five scholars, Beatles scholars, what the best Beatles album is, and they picked five different albums.
Of course. Love it.
Abbey Road, the White Album, Revolver, and I'll read from the guy who picked Sgt. Pepper, Matt Hurwitz, Beatles historian and Mix magazine contributing editor. says that sublime studio ingenuity in music is simply magical. They were always pushing the boundaries of current pop music recording craft. Every new release was awaited with excitement. What would the Beatles sound like this time? Sgt. Pepper was perhaps the most highly anticipated release by any group in the 60s. They took like 6 months to record it. And in fact, there were articles out being like, what are the Beatles doing?
Have they broken up?
Yeah, or they're done. You know, the idea of a rock album with a theme was relatively a new concept as well. You know, I just think, yeah, you could definitely debate it. It's hard to debate. It's as hard to debate as saying, is Citizen Kane the number one film of all time? And it's particularly hard for you and I to debate. I mean, we have our opinions about this music, but there are other people who live through the era.
True.
And maybe we're struck by Sgt. Pepper in such a way because of the time it came out and the excitement around it and that kind of thing. So it's hard, like, really hard for us to kind of ascertain what the real answer is. Yeah.
That's a really good point to think about, because we're obviously looking at things from the rearview mirror here and how, you know, what it looks like in 2014 or even when we became Beatle fans. But to have lived through that and have experienced this particular album at the time in summer of 1967, when it was the flower power, summer of love atmosphere going on, it probably was even more heightened than it is now, looking back all these years later. So that's a really good point. It's just like asking people, well, what were the Beatles like on Ed Sullivan? Well, you could look at them now and say, oh, they weren't all that good, or it was noisy or something, but boy, to be there at the time or live through that was a different experience.
Yeah.
So,
and then of course, secondarily is and why I brought up Citizen Kane is a lot of people watch Citizen Kane and they're like, "What are you talking about? It's sort of a depressing movie." It's like, yeah, but they never filmed the roof before.
Yeah, right.
That movie, you know.
Yeah.
And that's sort of how this album sits with me. Is it's like, whoa, they never really. You know, you listen to Beatles albums before that, and then this one, ideas are just so opened up, you know, it's like being for the benefit of Mr. Kite is just like mind-blowing. It's like, let's make it sound like a carnival, you know?
So, any idea was fair game, so.
Yeah,
and just putting in context a little bit, too, like you said, it was very anticipated because the Beatles had stopped touring, of course, in August of 66. And then they were so tired, they all went and did different things. So John went and filmed a movie, and Ringo was hanging out at home. And
offers rolled in.
And George went to India to work with Ravi Shankar, and they all kind of went their separate ways. And then when they came back together, it wasn't until November of 1966, and they first started the sessions, what they thought was going to be for this album, and it wasn't even a song that was on the album. It was Strawberry Fields Forever. And it kind of, at first there was this idea of doing that song, and then When I'm 64, looking back at nostalgia as a big theme, is kind of a main idea. But that kind of fizzled out quickly. And so then it was, well, all right, let's do this concept. Like you mentioned, this concept here, we're going to be someone else. So Paul is on a plane, right? This is very McCartney, isn't it? He's sitting on a plane. He's like, oh, I've got an idea. Let's be a different band. And we'll sing from different people and all this. And so that was kind of his idea. Let's get a long name that doesn't sound like Beatles and have it done this way. And then there's some debate, you know. John Lennon later said, oh, that was crap, you know, there was nothing to that, only the two songs were concept and the rest were could have been on any album.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, that's debatable.
Yeah, yeah.
But this is really the only time they had some time off before they did that refreshing, like, maybe they could have used a lot more of that. Like,
yeah.
Record an album, then take a lot of time off, then come back.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, they seem to just keep rushing through things, and particularly when they were recording and touring, it was just no time at all to just
reflect. Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. And the fact that they came back and didn't have the pressure of touring and could really live in the studio was a completely different story. This was, Revolver had a lot of great studio work on it, but this really took it to a much higher level in terms of experimentation, innovations, and now the audience was in the studio here for themselves making this creation. It was very, very different conception here. So yeah, I think that did do them some good to have some time off. So yeah.
And after this, you know, after Brian was gone, then
right.
It became a whole different thing.
Mm-hmm.
So this is sort of the wheelhouse, you know.
For them. Yeah, that's what they say. And
they're feeling good. They're relaxed. They stopped touring. They feel like the release of the pressure of like we have to be this.
Yeah.
This performing act and instead being a recording act and just like really sinking their teeth in, having George Martin at his peak, really everybody at their peak. I mean, yeah. Ringo's never better than on this album, drum wise. You know, maybe George hasn't quite hit his peak, but John Lennon's vocals on this are outstanding.
Yes.
The bass playing.
It's phenomenal.
Great. Yeah. And really the Paul songwriting as storytelling on this album is, never surpassed either. I don't think so. So, you know, definitely... Definitely hard to debate against it being, you know, somebody was like, no, it's terrible.
Well, no,
I'd be easy to get into an argument with them. So,
well, the people who say it's not the best, one argument they make is that while everything you said is true, they say it was kind of the beginning of the breakup too, because Paul was leading everything and seemed to be taking charge more. And Ringo, I think in the anthology, he said, oh yeah, that was the album that I learned to play chess, because they were spending so much time doing other parts that he would just lay down the track and then he'd be done. And so he was sitting around, and then George was kind of sour. Well, he was sour a lot, but he was particularly sour about that one. Said, well, I didn't, you know, a couple of good licks or something. He didn't have much good to say about it either. It was like a big Paul show. But I think that's maybe true, but there's still some great collaboration. And we'll talk about that as we get into each of the songs, how they work together. But I don't know, what do you think about that argument that it was the beginning of the breakup in a way?
So is the White Album bad too, and Abbey Road terrible? I guess everything after this is terrible because of that they weren't getting along or something.
Yeah.
I think it's ridiculous. There's an article in one of the recent Atlantic magazines about the particularly the John Lennon and Paul McCartney partnership,
right.
And that it was at times very tense, but that tense partnerships like that oftentimes create great things, great rewards. So maybe if they were getting along a lot better and it wasn't part of the breakup, they wouldn't have
pushed each other in that way. That's true.
So
well, certainly whatever you think of it, and we'll get into all the mechanics of the songs and things, but the album itself was obviously very, very innovative for the time. I'm holding my record of it here, which, of course, the cover is infamous and very, very famous, and it was very expensive, too, and we'll talk about that a little bit. But just some other innovations. The back of the album has the lyrics. That was the first time that any real major group had done something like that, to include the lyrics, and just it came with some some swag inside. I have my Sergeant Pepper mustache. I have my picture card. I have stripes. I have a badge. And then a little stand-up cutouts here that came with the album.
Yeah,
you can have for your very own. They're
poorly on the back of the CD where they had.
Oh yeah,
remember when CDs came in a bigger package?
Oh, I remember those. Yeah, yeah. So had some innovations in that way. Just the packaging was pretty neat. Are you a big fan of the cover?
Cover, yeah, I love the cover. I think the cover's endlessly fun to look at, and they threw a bunch of their heroes and people they liked on it. And,
yeah.
What do you think about the cover?
Yeah, it's by Peter Blake, was the designer, and I know EMI, the Beatles recording company, was furious because it cost so much, but it's just legendary. I mean, from the people on there, you've got Marilyn Monroe, you've got Bob Dylan on there, you have Karlheinz Stockhausen, the classical composer, the wax figures of the Beatles. Who are any other favorites of yours, that are favorite parts of the cover that you... Stu Sutcliffe is on there.
Stu, yeah, that's really... I like them from younger years.
Yeah, the wax.
Like the Beatles are on there, too. Yeah. Peppers, Lonely Hearts got bands on there, but also the Beatles.
Right, right.
Poe, W.C. Fields.
Yep. Yeah.
You know, pretty great.
Yeah, and all the symbols that are supposedly involved here, too, with the Paul. If you're a Paul is Dead fan, there are a lot of clues on this cover here with the man holding his hand above Paul McCartney, which is a death sign, and if you put the mirror up, if you put the record up to the mirror, it has messages, and Paul is here and there, and there's marijuana plants. I mean, all sorts of goofy things, but...
You know, fake replacement Paul's been real great.
He's
a long career.
He put on a hell of a concert this summer, didn't he?
I mean, do we know that original Paul is that good?
I don't know. This guy can sure play bass, though, I'll tell you. Yeah, so just the innovations in packaging and in this fashion, all the psychedelic clothing and recordings with just the different techniques they did. You can read about those in Jeff Emmerich's book. He was one of the engineers on this album and became a well-known producer and engineer. So just, you know, so innovative for the time.
What do you think about the mono versus stereo stuff?
I'll say that having these mono releases for all the albums up, well, not the last couple ones, so just up to the White Album, has changed the way I hear the Beatles, for sure. The mono version is the way that they, at least everyone says, they intended it to sound, and that they actually did the mixing for and helped out. And so that's definitely the case with Sgt. Pepper. The stories from George Martin and Jeff Emmerich said that the Beatles were there for the mono version, and then they went home, and then George Martin did the stereo and had no input from the Beatles themselves. So it's changed the way I hear it, and for the better, and for the early albums and just everything. It's just a different experience. And I think when we go track by track, we can mention some of them, but there are definitely noticeable things, particularly in one song, very noticeable.
Yeah, one song
really stands out.
It's like the right speed in one thing, and then a wrong speed in a different one.
Yeah, right.
So
I don't know. If you have the mono ones too, and what's your opinion just generally, mono versus stereo?
I've been very much enjoying the mono ones. When they released the mono, they also, for the first time, put out stereo versions of a couple of the early ones.
Right.
And those are just, like, completely worthless.
Awful.
Just, like, completely, like, what are you doing? But I do think there is some value to both the mono and the stereo of this album, particularly of the White Album.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because they started to pay more attention to it. And a couple of these songs sound really good in stereo.
Yeah.
And a couple of them sound really, really, really good in mono. So it's definitely, you know, and we'll point out the differences, like you said.
Yeah,
but, yeah. I I sort of favor the mono version of this these days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we grew up listening to the stereo that I think our ears are particularly acute, and so we can really notice. Like, I still, when I hear the mono one, I notice something different. It really stands out because it's so ingrained in me, the stereo.
Yeah.
It makes it even more interesting to listen to. It's always like a fresh experience hearing them.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
So that's very cool. So what do you say? Should we go get into this a little bit here? Or?
Yeah, let's do it.
Let's hear some tunes. We heard the opening track, which is the sets up the whole supposed concept.
Now, it's got a crowd noise there. And that apparently was all from a recording that George Martin had done of Peter Sellers and that group, like a live comedy show. So that's why you also get some laughter and stuff.
And then the horns come in. There are horns on there. And it's a really rocking guitar from Paul and George here. Really, really into this. And Paul always tells the story in concert. We've heard this a million times about how the album, it hasn't even come out yet. The album was like, Jimi Hendrix somehow heard Sergeant Pepper, and he was playing it on a concert that Paul was at. It was like a tribute to him, and he thought that was so cool.
Like the album came out, and then like a couple days later.
Yeah, it was like really, yeah. So he just had already learned it. But yeah, it sets things up really well, and it's obviously the name of the album, so it's a good start.
Well, of course, it goes right into our... it must have been a shock to everyone to get a Ringo right off the bat.
I know. Song two.
And not only a Ringo, but maybe the best Ringo vocal of all time, arguably.
Maybe, yeah.
And with a little help from my friends, let's hear it.
Would you stand up and walk out on me? Lend me your ears and I'll sing you a song, and I'll try not to sing out of key. Oh, I get by with a little help from my friends. I get high with a little help from my friends. Gonna try with a little help from my friends.
Ah, great vocal performance by Billy Shears.
Yeah. Now, true or not that it's about getting stoned?
According to them, that would be false. It's false. About getting spiritually high.
Yes. And I agree with you completely. But when I was in a band back in high school, just shortly after high school, I was in a band in high school, and then shortly after high school, we were invited back to play for an assembly of children, basically, at my school, and we played this song, and the one of the teachers got really upset because they were like, you can't sing that song.
You're promoting drugs.
Yeah, and I'm like, it's easy to sing. It's a very innocent song.
Yeah.
So it was like very much a strange kind of situation for me. But I've always loved the song. I always thought it's just brilliant. The background vocals are great. The bass playing's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Big win.
All the above. And there's a great little subtle moment where Ringo, I think he moves to the ride cymbal or something. In the last verse, it's just like a very subtle shift. That's the kind of things that Ringo would do. You know, he's real steady, but then would just do these really subtle, tasteful kinds of changes. And so listen for the last verse or so. It's a nice change. But yeah, the bass part's really amazing. And so you have this great song, The Innocence, from Ringo, and that supposedly ends the concept album part of it. But then it's followed up by definitely one of the greatest psychedelic songs from John Lennon of all time, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. So do you buy the story behind Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, that it was little Julian Lennon drew a picture of a friend named Lucy, and then he brought it home to John, and John said, "What's this?" And Julian said, "Oh, it's Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds."
I might buy it, but I also think that I'm not naive enough to think that maybe this one, whereas I do think the other one is not about smoking marijuana, I do think this one is about LSD.
Yes, and what was the Beatles' drug of choice during Sgt. Pepper?
LSD.
Yes. Just happens to work out that way, doesn't it? I don't know.
Apparently one day in the studio, John accidentally took some and then was up on the roof. And
yeah, he almost fell, and George Martin was looking at him weirdly and going, "What's going on here?" He said that was the last time he took it in the studio.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can
you
see
that. You don't want to lose the approval of George Martin.
No. No. But what are your thoughts on Lucy? Well, why don't we hear it first, and then we can talk about Lucy and the Sky with Diamonds.
Picture yourself in a boat on a river with tangerine trees and marmalade skies. Somebody calls you, you answer quite slowly. A girl with kaleidoscope eyes.
What do you think of Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds?
It's one of John's great songs, I think. It has a really wistful, again, maybe kind of innocent-sounding vocal, just this really plain, floating on top of the music vocal that he has, that just is so ethereal. And it does have a little processing on it, so it sounds even more psychedelic with the phasing, but it just like a floating sound, which makes sense.
Yeah, and he's singing the one note.
Yeah, droning one pitch. Yeah,
sort of a drone, but that effect gives it a sort of like a depth.
Yeah.
It's just a tremendous song. Like this and the aforementioned Strawberry Fields, which isn't on the album, but really should have been.
Yeah.
Maybe if that was on the album too, as well as Penny Lane, it would feel like more of a concept album. Sometimes I think it is a concept album. I buy it as a concept album.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fake band, and here's some of the different weird songs that they play.
Yeah, no, that works. That works.
So it works. But the Elton John one was the one that was stuck in my head. So maybe the first time I heard this, I was like, "What's this?"
Yeah.
Different, it's so different, but
I thought it might have been the William Shatner version of Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds that got you into the song.
You know, the first time I heard there was a compilation thing called Golden Throats.
There were a couple of volumes of Golden Throats. Yeah, those were excellent.
Yeah, and it had William Shatner's version of Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds on it. And the first time I heard it was, I had purchased it because I'd heard it was funny. And I was playing it in my car, and I was laughing so hard that I almost wrecked my car. this ridiculous thing. If you haven't heard it.
Oh, you have to hear it. It has the Salvation Army Band background singers on it. And
yeah.
really terrible. And he's just all over the place on that. So it's well worth a listen.
Yeah, for sure.
But great classic Lennon for sure on that one. And you hear a lot of Paul and great background vocals on the chorus too.
Oh,
the,
yeah.
The little organ lick, da-da-da-da, is fun too. So great stuff.
Well, that song is followed on the album, of course, by Getting Better.
It's getting better all the time. I used to get mad at my school.
I can't complain.
The teachers that taught me weren't cool.
I can't complain.
They're holding me down, turning me round, filling me up with your rules. I've got to admit, it's getting better.
It's hard to pick a time to fade these.
I know.
They're all so good.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, Getting Better, it's funny. Yesterday, there was an interview with Paul McCartney in, I don't know where he was, but he was with a supermodel who they were talking about his music and about writing with John Lennon, and he was talking about how great it was that they could just roll right off each other. And he brought up this song, how Jimmy Nicol, the former sub for Ringo, the drummer who filled in when Ringo was sick, he used to say, it's getting better, or something like that. And so that was kind of what it was. And Paul started out the song, oh, it's getting better all the time. And then John supposedly walked in and said, oh, it can't get much worse. And so it just stuck and became part of the song. And he said that was the magic, that John would always have the compliment to whatever he would say. And this is a song that he obviously likes because he plays it in concert, or he did on a bunch of tours.
Yeah, I think it's a terrific song, and I once again back to this whole thing about the concept of what's the concept of this concept album, other than what's the theme? What's a theme that runs through it? Is a lot of this sort of a day in the life, sort of normal life. It's funny, they're pretending to be something that they're not.
Yeah.
And at the same time all these songs are about like sort of mundane real life English kind of things. Lovely Rita, Meet Her Maid,
yeah,
and the life, you know.
Yeah, that's true.
Eat Tea and Meet the Wife, and you know, all
very
of the,
English.
Yeah. Yeah, all of those types of things. So you know, they're mixed with he's spectacular, like Lucy the Sky with Diamonds and Mr. Kite and everything. But yeah. This is one of many examples of that, I think.
Yeah, yeah, it's one of my favorites on the album. And actually, I put this song and the next one really together. They're both McCartney songs and they're also good compliments to each other. So Getting Better goes pretty much right into Fixing a Hole, which is another McCartney tune and a pretty quirky one. So maybe we can hear a little bit.
I'm fixing a hole where the rain gets in and stops my mind from wandering where it will go. I'm filling the cracks that ran through the door and kept my mind from wandering where it will go. And it really doesn't matter if I'm wrong or right, where I belong.
Man, so Fixin' a Hole is a really underrated McCartney song to me, I've always thought.
This is one of the few where I prefer the stereo a little bit. You just really can hear George's guitar. We were both kind of...
Oh, yeah, it's amazing. In a fake
guitar to get here.
Yeah.
And Ringo's percussion on, well, on the whole album, but this is one place where it really stands out. If you just listen to the Ringo drums on this, it's just spectacular.
Yeah, it is, and it's got a nice instrumentation too. There's the harpsichord on it, which some books say it's George Martin, some say it's Paul. That is a unique sound, and it has, like, when George's solo, it's like got this swing, like laid back slack feel that just grooves, and it's not a sound that the Beatles have a lot, so it's pretty fresh sounding.
Yeah, really. I mean, and it's a very conceptual lyric.
Yeah. It
kind of matches the, in a way, the Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds kind of mind expanding, mind opening kind of lyrics, but it's coming from Paul's perspective. So yeah. I love it.
Yeah.
Now we haven't talked too much about the differences between the stereo and mono. But this one, there's a huge difference. It's She's Leaving Home. So I'm going to play just the start of She's Leaving Home stereo, and then I'll play the start of She's Leaving Home mono, and we'll talk about it.
Wednesday morning at 5 o'clock, as the day begins, silently closing her bedroom door, leaving the note that she hoped would say more. She goes downstairs to the kitchen, clutching her handkerchief.
She's Leaving Home, that obviously very different sound, and you know what happened with the two different recordings of that?
Yeah, explain.
Well, they did the mono album first, so the mono version is actually how it's supposed to sound. That was the real version, but then they were mixing the stereo, and somehow it was so slowed down, and they didn't fix it. So it ended up being a half step lower, so... The real song is in the key of F major, but then it was lowered to E major, which is a half step in musical terms. So it also seems much slower in that as well.
It's 11 seconds longer.
Yes.
It's big difference. When I was listening to it today, I was like, wow, this is so much more lively, mono version. You know,
yeah,
I just love the song, but either version of it, but quite different,
very different. And this is a controversial song, at least in the mind of George Martin, because he didn't actually do the scoring for it. There's no Beatle playing on this one, it's just Paul and John singing. But Paul had wanted George Martin to come up with a score and arrange this for strings and harp, as you hear, but George Martin was busy at another session, and so Paul just said, all right, well, fine, I'll get someone else. And so he brought in this guy, Mike Leander, to come in and score it, and George Martin was really hurt by that because, you know, obviously they were close, and he felt he was being slighted. And then he was, to add insult to injury, he had to conduct the orchestra on someone else's arrangement and make it happen. So George was a good soldier to do that. But it is very, it doesn't sound like a George Martin arrangement to me, at least. And And actually, some people who don't like the song complain about the tinkling harps, and it's like a little too syrupy in the arrangement. So I don't know what you think of that.
Yeah, I can see that point of view. I could see it being... I mean, there are days when I'm like, maybe that's why the stereo version ended up so lazily being put together.
Yeah, could be. Could be.
Just maybe George was just
like, he's had enough.
Art is not in it, you know? Yeah. So,
but in terms of the lyrics and the story and the musical construction of the song, it's, again, a really impressive song in just about every way.
And the vocals between John and Paul sound so great.
Mm-hmm.
That's so great. It's so sad of a song. You know, it makes me think, too, like, this was one that I was talking about when I mentioned the storytelling.
Right, right.
Like, Paul's storytelling, he paints this whole picture. You know, that's part of what makes this album so successful, even though maybe there isn't any songs, like, personal that in my life on this album.
Yeah.
They're painting a picture of real life.
Yeah.
Through this storytelling that is very moving. And this definitely is a great example of that.
Yeah, and this and another song we'll talk about later were actually written about real events. This is actually a story about a real thing that happened, real situation. So, but it's told in a really poetic way. I think that is more than just reading it out of the newspaper. But it's very, yeah. There's a sadness to this that comes through. Obviously, it's a sad story, but it, even more so in the storytelling.
Yeah. Now, a guy walks into a antique store and sees a poster on the wall. Turns into a crazy loop-de-loo.
Yeah.
Called Being for the Benefit of Mr. Kite. Let's hear it, and then we'll talk about it.
For the benefit of Mr. Kite, there will be a show tonight on trampoline. The Hendersons will all be there, late of Pablo Frank is there, what a scene. Over men and horses, hoops and garters, lastly through a hogshead of real fire. In this way, Mr. K will challenge the world. The celebrated Mr. K performs his feat on Saturday at Bishop's Gate.
Nice to hear John's voice again after being silent for the last three songs. Well, I mean, lead singing. But, yeah, this always stuck to me because it was the last song on the record of side one.
Yeah.
And it has a really prominent place on it.
Through the years, this has grown in my estimation. When I first heard it, I don't think I was into it very much.
Mm-hmm.
It is just sort of reciting a poster.
Yeah, which I had on a t-shirt, I might add. I bought a t-shirt at Beatle Fest Chicago like 20 years ago, and now I use it as a rag because it has holes in it, but it had the original poster on it, and it's very cool, so you can wear it.
Fixing a hole.
I know!
That shirt better, but... you know, I like John had this idea for a song, and he came in and he was like, "I want to make this a sound like." He said, "I want to smell the sawdust."
Yeah.
On the floor, and they just went for it, and you know, as little as George Martin had to do with the previous song, he had a complete mastery on this song. So.
Definitely, and the story is pretty neat, how they, all the calliope organs at the end, they tried to get a pump organ, but they couldn't rent one, so they found old tapes of calliope organs, and they cut the tapes and then just threw them up in the air, so yeah. Little pieces of tape, and then just spliced them together in random order, and so that's why they sound the way they do, and it all worked, lightning struck on that.
Yeah, absolutely. This is another one where there are some differences in the mono and the stereo. I prefer the mono for sure. There's a little bit of extra of those.
Yeah, you can really hear them prominently, too.
Yeah. So, but kind of a, you know, I think this and the next song that we're going to hear are people are more on the fence about some of the other songs in the album. The next song,
so let's flip over the record here and see what comes next.
Yeah. Well, who haven't we heard from?
You know who's been awfully silent is the Quiet Beetle. So I wonder where he's been.
Oh, here he comes.
Yeah.
So where do you stand on the within you, without you sort of conundrum, which is that some people feel like it's the dud of the album?
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, it is controversial in a way because it's the most remote sounding of any Beatles song on this album and even in this period, really. It's so far removed from anything that they did. And George is the only one who's involved on it, and it's an Indian piece all the way through. I'd say the lyrics are very philosophical, although some people find them pompous and a little too, you know, who's this 25-year-old coming up with these kinds of things? But it's pretty powerful in a way. There's a lot of good quotable lines in the lyrics, I think. And it's a maturity. Just think, like, a couple of years before, George was writing You Like Me Too Much, or sort of like fluffy tunes, and then he gets to this. So it's quite a leap forward, I think, for him.
I think it's underrated as far, particularly the middle section, musical section. You've got the musicians playing the sort of traditional Indian part. You've got George sort of calling, answering them with the sitar. And you've got a very subtle and very well done actual orchestra.
Yeah, cellos and, yeah.
Playing along with all of that. And somehow it all works together very well. I think it works on this album particularly, because we had Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, we had Fixing a Hole, so I think it's sort of the third part of that. And the last part of that's going to be sort of A Day in the Life,
which
kind of brings the sort of two sides of the album kind of together, like the mundane real life stuff and the sort of mind expanding.
Yeah, it fits in that regard, I think.
Yeah,
it's not one I choose to listen to all the time, though. You sort of have to be in the mood for it. Yeah. But it's the arrangement, yeah, as you say, the arrangement by George Martin is just really sophisticated and intricately done. So, but of course, what's most famous is the ending, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, what happens at the end?
There's laughs.
Yeah.
There's and there are different laughs on the mono and stereo. It's different laughs altogether.
Yeah. So what's up next?
The very quaint Next track called When I'm 64. Let's listen to it.
When I get older, losing my head, many years from now, will you still be sending me a Valentine? Birthday greetings, bottle of wine. If I'd been out till 2:45, would you lock the door? Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
When I'm 64. How do you feel about When I'm 64?
It's a fun song. It's very, very English. Probably, to me, the most English-sounding song. Paul really hams up the accent, too. Sounds extremely English. I like it because I'm mentioned in it. That's really the main reason why. Because Vera, Chuck, and Dave. So he's talking about me in this song, really. I like to tell myself that.
If he had just said Vera, Chris, and Dave.
Yeah, oh.
We would have been able to play that at the beginning of every episode.
That would have been our theme song, I know. But I like When I'm 64, and it's a little cheesy, but it's a pretty clever arrangement, and I like the clarinets, and it's nice. Yeah.
Well, Ringo's spectacular on it.
Yeah.
Absolutely spectacular.
Nails that style.
Just listen to Ringo on it. He just is wonderful on it. It is a skipper a lot of the time. I mean, let's be honest. If he started playing in a concert, I'd probably, use that opportunity to go to the restroom.
Yes.
There's been some crazy versions of it. There was,
Oh, yeah.
Cover versions and stuff.
Didn't we play one? It was Keith Moon, wasn't it?
Keith Moon, yeah. but it's good. It's great. It's great. It's great. It's if it wasn't sandwiched right here in the middle of this album, I'd probably be harsher on it than I am.
Yeah. Well, it's nice levity after Within You, Without You, though. It is kind of it cleanses the palate a little bit for what comes next, which is another McCartney song. So we're 2 for 2 here with lovely Rita. And this is one he's trotted out in concert not that long ago, I think. He's played this.
Yeah, it's a pretty underrated song, I think. And I enjoy it. Let's hear a little bit of it, though.
Yeah, that's a good one. It's got a great bass line that really stands out. Great chord progression. It has a good background vocal to it. And
sweet piano.
Yeah, the honky-tonk kind of piano in there. But very British also, too. Very English. And we don't call them meter maids here. And they don't fill out tickets in little white books either.
plus, the last, say, 30 seconds of this is just a sort of a little vamp.
Trippy, yeah.
Trippy vamp, and it perfectly goes in too, and I think we'll just go right into the next song, Good Morning, Good Morning, which is just excellent.
Wife and nothing to say, but what a day, how
do. I've got nothing to say, but it's okay.
Good morning, good morning, good morning, yeah.
Going to work, don't wanna go, feeling low down. Heading for home, you start to roam, then you're in town. Everybody knows there's nothing doing, everything is closed, it's like a ruin, everyone you see.
So, good morning, good morning. Great, yep. Lennon song that supposedly he wrote when he was, it was from a cornflakes commercial that he heard on TV, and was just kind of mindlessly looking for something to write about, so he heard that in the jingle for the song. And he didn't like it, though. He said it was rubbish later in one of the interviews. He said, this song is rubbish. It was a piece of nothing or something like that.
Yeah, he liked it. You know, I take all of that with a grain of salt, because he the whole second side of Abbey Road, he's like, oh, it's just garbage.
Yeah.
Like, come on, dude.
Yeah.
He just, he wants everybody to adore the songs like God or something.
Oh, yeah,
like that.
The biggies.
And right. These were supposed to just dismiss as nothing, but I think that song, the most similar to song to that in the Beatles catalog, is probably Got to Get You Into My Life, which vocally has a little more going for it, but they're very similar, very rapid pace, a lot of horns, good energy to it, you know.
And I would throw in She Said, too, because they have the same, the meter changes all the time. You can't try tapping your foot to it, and you won't be able to, you won't come out in the same place each time you do it, because it's changing meter, so it's very unpredictable.
Of course, this one also includes a lot of barking dogs.
Yeah, a lot of animals.
Yeah. A lot of animals, and of course that bass line is just crazy.
Oh, yeah. And John just sounds so good on that. He sounds just, his voice just is so top-notch in this one. And then after that, it leads in. Now, interesting, there's a difference on the mono album. You have the stereo album, you have a, I don't know, is it a, some animal sound that goes right in, it turns into a guitar lick, which takes you into the reprise of Sergeant Pepper, but that's not on the mono track.
The stereo version's very smooth.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Mono version's like really kind
choppy.
And choppy and sounds weird.
Yeah.
But the mono version has a lot more Paul Histrionics. I love it. It's just,
yeah, you don't hear that on the stereo one at all.
Oh. Yeah. So, I have to make an isolated track of some Paul Histrionics.
I think that'd be great. That'd be great. The reprise. I mean, it's short. It's $1.19 to get through.
It's it's a quick little hint. I guess it was... it was a good idea to place it where they placed it, though, instead of ending the album.
That's true.
Sort of being a lead-in to such a monstrous, fantastic, spectacular song.
Yeah.
I can't give enough superlatives about how I feel about the next song.
It's hard to even talk about it because everything's been said, and, I mean, it's legendary. Obviously, it's always voted in the top three, probably, Beatles songs of all time for its innovations, for its lyrical qualities, for the joint composition, for the orchestration. I mean, every single part about it is fantastic and notable. So,
what I'll say about it, we'll play a chunk of it here. The middle section where John just goes into the is not necessary to the song, but at the same time, it brings the whole thing together. I just feel like that is like the peak of the greatness of the Beatles. Is like, let's add a section here that there's nothing.
Yeah.
And John singing.
Yeah, I know. It's really, from start to finish, it's just quite a production. And there's a great, in the documentary, I think it's in the anthology, but there was a documentary made right around the 20th anniversary of George Martin talking about, I think it was called, it was 20 years ago today, and George Martin talks about the first take of hearing the beginning of the song and John singing by himself or just with, accompanied with his guitar, and he said it just, the voice gave him shivers, chills listening to it. So we can check out a little of the beginning there, and just everybody loves A Day in the Life, but I think this is one of the few that really earns its reputation. Isn't it funny, though, that middle section sort of has nothing to do with the other sections because those were written about the newspaper. And it's like Paul said, oh, I've got this fragment. And John said, oh, I've got this fragment. Yeah. Let's put them together. But it all works amazingly. It all works.
Yeah. It's just a masterful song. Some people argue. I think it's similar to the argument against the album being the greatest album of all time.
Yeah.
Like, well, it's really not about that much of anything.
Right.
The song. But I just...
Yeah, whatever.
But the drums are perfect. Yeah. We were struck just then by Paul's on piano. It's the first time you hear a little hint of Paul on piano, which makes you think about Let It Be and
Hey Jude, and
a few of those that are going to come after this. So.
Yeah, just a masterpiece and a great way to close the album. But, of course, that's not really the end of the album. You've had all this orchestration. You've had the...
Fades out.
Yeah, the fade out and how that was happened, but...
Perfect ending.
Except...
We did it! There's this gibberish! Garbage gibberish.
As a joke.
As a joke that they toss on the end. For no reason. It's one of my... We're gonna have a episode someday of worst Beatle things.
Inner
groove is there's just no reason for it.
No.
What's the joke? Who's laughing?
Do you think it mars the like it sort of ruins the spectacle or the monumental nature of A Day in the Life?
It doesn't ruin anything, but yeah. It's just, it's like, I swear they thought, this will be funny.
Yeah.
Guy will be really high. He'll have his record on, uh-huh. And think the record's over, and then it'll freak him out.
Yep, and his dog will go crazy, because there's a dog whistle on there, too, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hilarious. You know, I used to be able to hear a little bit of the dog whistle.
Yeah, yeah.
In younger years, but I can't hear it anymore. It's on my rock and roll playing game.
I know. Well, that you can always, since you know it's coming, you can always stop the music before that kicks in. So just, you know, enjoy the last chord and then cut it before that comes in. But, yeah. Otherwise, yeah, that's kind of a lame ending. But
now,
yeah,
this album... arguably greatest album of all time, led to a movie.
Oh.
Arguably worst movie. Called Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Of course, you know, it starred members of the Bee Gees.
Late 70s, 78, I think.
Peter Frampton.
Yep. Steve Martin.
Steve Martin. Those ridiculous, sort of wild and crazy guy versus himself. Alice Cooper's in it.
George Burns.
Oh, I forgot Billy Preston. Oh, yeah. Isn't it? George Burns, yeah. George Burns as Mr. Kite.
Yes. Yeah. Horrible.
Well, Dud, if you've heard any of the songs from the soundtrack, we played a few of them. They're all awful.
I think the only one that made any made any charts were it was Aerosmith's version of Come Together. Wasn't that in there? Or no, they did something on there.
Yeah, yep. Aerosmith did something that was not too
bad.
And this year, released in October, is a album called With a Little Help from My Friends, which is the Flaming Lips, along with some goofy kind of guest stars, Moby and a few people, Dr. Dog.
Isn't Miley Cyrus on there?
Miley Cyrus is on it in a couple places.
Yeah.
But I think that is intent. It's getting sort of mixed reviews, but I think it's getting mixed reviews from people who are like, oh, they're seriously messing with.
Yeah.
Let's have fun. This is a goof.
It's a joke, yeah.
For album, it's a goof. It's a joke. It's called My Friends. Very silly, you know, and kind of liked a couple of the tracks of it. Maybe we'll bring it up at some future point or play one of them on one of our cover.
Yeah, definitely, because the Flaming Lips are actually a very Beatle-influenced group. They really focus on the psychedelic era, and I think they're pretty good musicians and do a good job, but I think people are put off maybe by some of the guests on this one, like Miley Cyrus or people like that, who they don't think are worthy of doing Beatles songs.
Do you think the Flaming Lips would even exist without the album Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts?
I don't think so. No, no.
Or that maybe another Flaming Lips also did a cover, an entire album cover version of Dark Side of the Moon.
Yeah.
That's another album that probably happened in the way it happened because there was, you
Sergeant
know,
Pepper. Yeah. Sergeant
Pepper.
And another one, which is a literal connection, because you and I are both Pink Floyd fans, but during the recording of Sergeant Pepper, and actually during Lovely Rita, I think, suddenly these four guys from another studio across the way in Abbey Road were brought in and got to meet the Beatles, and they were Pink Floyd recording Piper at the Gates of Dawn at the time. So that was pretty, you know, serendipitous that they were there at the same time.
I wonder if Sid and John took some acid together. Yeah.
Wouldn't be surprised. So just all sorts of that's you know, even if you're not, if you don't think Sgt. Pepper is the greatest album of all time, it was extremely influential, and I think we wouldn't have had nearly the types of music we've had since without it. It was such an innovative album.
Yeah, I agree. Ratings is going to be real easy.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no doubt about this one. It's I'll admit that it's not my favorite Beatles album, but
I can't wait to see what is.
I know. That'll be another, maybe an agree to disagree or a debate or something.
Maybe episode 100.
Episode 100. We'll bring our favorite albums and go head to head. But it's not my favorite, but I think, you know, you can't deny its importance, and the songs really do hold up. They don't sound as dated as I thought they would in comparison to other albums. You know, I listen to 60s on 6 a lot in the Sirius station in my car, and you'll hear these psychedelic songs like Incense and Peppermints and Crimson and Clover, over and over.
Yeah.
They just sound so dated. And these songs don't have that same, you know, sound to me. There's the songwriting and the production is just so good.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well,
This
has been a great 50 episodes. We hope to keep it going.
Yes. It's a lot of fun.
We really genuinely appreciate all of you who listen, and if you wanted to do something for us for our 50th episode, please go to iTunes and give us a good rating, good review, write a little review, give us a 5-star rating. That'd be a real treat for us.
Yeah, definitely, we'd love it.
Yeah,
and it's really neat to see where all of you are from, because we on our site, it just shows where people tune the show in from. Doesn't have names or anything, but it just says countries, and it's really exciting. We want to say hello to our listeners out in Australia and New Zealand and the UK and France and Canada and all around the world. So it's really pretty cool.
We consider you all our friends.
Yes, we couldn't do it without a little help from our friends
here. That's right. So let's go out with that mono version of the reprise of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
All right, sounds good. And we'll catch you next time. We're going to finish up our year with a couple more episodes. We got our gift episode coming next, and then one more, probably. And
One or two more, a couple surprises.
Yes. So
maybe another album review mixed in there. We'll see.
Got it.
So, all right.